We're at the Royal Burial Ground at Sutton Hoo.
And you can see the two mounds in which ship burials were found. First, we've got the one that was found robbed in the reconstructed Mound 2 behind us. And then we've got the one that was found intact in Mound 1, which is way off in the distance.
And Time Team is back at Sutton Hoo for 2025. And you can follow our new dig on the Time Team podcast. Should we get going?
We must. Welcome to the Time Team podcast and welcome to Sutton Hoo. I'm Dr. Helen Geek and this is Martin Williams.
And we are back once again. I got to stay here last night.
I am so jealous.
I know. And this morning I ticked an item off a Byzantine bucket list, which is that I got to, I went on a run.
Oh, how lovely.
I went
lovely.
On a run around Sutton Hoo. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, it's famous for its wildlife and its nightingales and all sorts of lovely things.
Yeah, it feels quite surreal to be here. Time Team is very much back. And as you can see from the backdrop maybe behind us, you'll be able to see in just a moment, we've got some activity on site. Well, she'll give you a little look a little bit later on. If you missed our previous episode, by the way, you can go and catch that now wherever you get your podcast. We, amongst other things, talked to Professor Martin Carver, who was here alongside Helen in the 1980s on one of the previous digs at Sutton Hoo. That is available to listen to. And we're here again with a few more updates for you.
We are, and we are very honoured to have with us today Dr. John Gator.
Royalty.
Who is a geophysicist extraordinaire. I haven't promoted you, have I, John? You are a doctor.
I think I am a doctor.
Good, good. And you are a geophysicist extraordinaire.
And I believe you did say the Rolls Royce of geophysics.
Well, you certainly are. You have done a lot of geophysics over the years at Sutton Hoo, but what did it feel like coming back this year and looking at it? You know, we've only got 1 year left. We've only got 4 weeks to finish this project.
And there's so many anomalies out there, I want to see them dug. We need to know what they mean.
Mm, absolutely.
We've been looking at them for years. Have we got tree holes? Have we got lumps of metal? Ferrous metal.
I think it's really sensible to say that because actually the excitement of the Broomswell bucket has meant that I keep slightly forgetting that the point of what we're doing here is to establish what is going on over the whole field by testing a few geophysical anomalies and seeing if they present a coherent picture that we can then use to interpret the rest of the field, isn't it?
You've hit the nail on the head.
Yes.
Absolutely spot on.
Yes.
We understand ditches, they're clear responses, but when you get blobs, for want of a better word, we don't know what's causing that blob, and that's why the excavations will help us. Sutton Hoo is a fantastic site, we know, but actually from geophysics point of view, it's one of the most difficult sites we have to work on, and that's because there's not been a lot of occupation. We're dealing largely with burials. Mounds that have been eroded completely, they don't always have a ring ditch around them, so identifying things, anything Anglo-Saxon, is always difficult. You know that. Every time I talk to you about not another Anglo-Saxon cemetery, please.
Yes, I know. And correct me if I'm wrong, but is the problem that you dig out soil, you bury a person in it, and then you put that soil back without burning it, without adding rubbish, without adding iron or anything like that that would make it distinguishable? All you've done is mix it up, and that's not generally enough.
It's not enough. There's no magnetic contrast because the same soil has gone back in.
Yeah.
We don't have a bone detector per se. So we're still reliant on seeing contrasts, be they moisture contrasts, magnetic contrasts, or a variety of other physical, geophysical features.
I have been led to believe over the years, right back to the 1980s, that the Sutton Hoo soil is particularly difficult for geophysics generally, and some kinds worse than others, because it is so free-draining and so homogeneous in texture, really.
Sandy, would you say?
That's the word.
Sandy, that's the word.
I knew there was a short word. Yes, I knew there was a shorter word.
Yes. But sometimes, you know, so I'd like to know whether that's true. You know, what has got better over the years that we couldn't get really anything with geophysics out of the Mound Cemetery 40 years ago, and now it's absolutely fantastic.
We've got more sensitive sensors, and so they can see smaller magnetic changes, but also we're now using radar. Last year, radar came into its own when we were down on Riverview Field, when we had that dock feature and we looked into the ground, could they be ship's timbers? I think they're more likely the foundations within the dock. And this year, what we're hoping to do is find the earlier stream courses adjacent to that dock, and that would then confirm that interpretation.
So would you say Sutton Hoo holds an important place in the history of geophysics?
Absolutely.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Without a doubt.
It's coming home.
Yes.
Geophysics is coming home.
Right, Helen, I'm leaving you in just a moment because I'm going to be going out and exploring some of the other parts of this vast site here at Sutton Hoo. But before I go, I think we should talk about another project that's connected to Sutton Hoo, but it's actually happening just a little down the road.
Ah, you mean the ship reconstruction project in
Indeed.
Woodbridge. Now, this is the precise experimental reconstruction of the enormous ship that was found in Mound 1 in the Mound Cemetery, just a few hundred metres away.
Absolutely. And they've been working very, very hard to make this reconstruction as authentic as they possibly can. It's taken them a few years already, and I think they still have a few more to go. But how are they getting on? Time Team went to find out.
I'm Jack Barnard, the project manager for the Sutton Hoo Ships Company. We are actually in the long shed where the ship is being built. So behind me you can see the production so far. So this is the Sutton Hoo ship that was unearthed in 1939 over at Sutton Hoo. So far we have built about two-thirds of the hull. It's been a slow burn, this ship. I think the Anglo-Saxons would have built it in less than a year. However, it's taken us upwards of 4 or 5 years so far. But that's because we've got volunteer workforce and we're learning how to do it as we go. They would have been skilled in all of the techniques and would have used the tools day in, day out, whereas our volunteers have had to relearn all of that sort of 1,400 years later.
I'm Roy. I've been one of the volunteers now for about 3.5 years. This is the main centre frame for the boat, and it's the longest of all the frames. It covers about 12 planks in total. We've shaped the bottom of it to fit the planks, and this is the top surface. So we want to get this reasonably flat so the Anglo-Saxon rowers don't get splinters in the feet.
My name's David Keeble and I'm the volunteer coordinator for the Sutton Ship Company. It's such an iconic ship. It's part of, very much part of Woodbridge's history. Who wouldn't want to be involved when it's on your doorstep? It's probably the biggest tourist attraction that's in Woodbridge really at the moment, without a doubt.
It's just going to be incredible to be in something that would also have been in the water in 625 and to experience life and rowing like the Anglo-Saxons would have done. What an incredible experience to be part of putting a part of history back together again, because no one else has done that. You know, that all of the treasures have either been, you know, they're in the British Museum, they've either been replicated or whatever, whereas the ship has never been made. So, you know, it will be a first. How many people can say they've been part of a first in their life?
Now, Martin said he was going to go and explore somewhere else on the Sutton Hoo estate. Martin, where are you?
Yeah, I've come to Tranmer House, which is really, really famous in the story of Sutton Hoo, because this is where Edith Pretty lived. And if you've ever seen that film, The Dig, on Netflix, you'll know how instrumental she was in getting the archaeology done on the mounds. The thing is, the National Trust, who own this property, actually allow you to stay at Tranmer House, and I have been staying here, which I cannot believe. But not only that, I am staying where Edith Pretty actually lived. So I wanted to just show you around, basically, and take you through to, I think this is the best room. There's a few rooms here, they've divided it up, and this one's called Deben, and I think I've lucked out, because I really do think this is the best one. Look at this, it's so good. Look at the rooms here. My colleague Neil is in this one, beautiful. And if you come through here, the wood looks gorgeous. I'm going to run up this corridor and just show you this. So this is the main room. Look at this. Imagine you get to stay here. This is pretty impressive, pretty special. But I don't think you've even seen the best bit. The best bit is the bathroom. So this is actually, well, it's Edith Pretty's bathroom. Look at it. Look at that bath. I had a bath in there. That's incredible. There is one more little surprise, actually, and that is the view that you get from the terrace, from the veranda. And it's a pretty iconic view. You can imagine Edith Pretty sitting out here with a cup of tea, just like one of our Sutton Hoo volunteers, Lyndon Hawkins, who's here. Lovely to see you.
And you.
What a beautiful place, and what an amazing place to be as a volunteer. This house is really special in the Sutton Hoo story, and it's special because of the person who lived here. Tell me a little about Edith Pretty.
Yeah, it's a great privilege to volunteer at Sutton Hoo. Edith Pretty moved here with her husband Frank in 1926 when they got married. Edith had been interested in archaeology since she was a child, and there were burial grounds on the land that they bought.
And it's at that point, wasn't it, that she found this spiritualism and thought she'd seen something, and then she wanted them investigated.
Yes, she did think she'd seen something, and so she got in contact with the Ipswich Museum, and they suggested Basil Brown, who was an amateur archaeologist.
And the rest pretty much is history from that point on, isn't it? How much did Edith Pretty actually kind of get involved with the work that was going on the mounds just behind you?
She didn't actually do any of the archaeology, but she was watching a lot of what was going on and bringing people to see it. Her son Robert was watching as well. So I think she was very, very interested.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing Edith Pretty's story and also being a volunteer here at Sutton Hoo. It's a brilliant job you're doing. What a great place to do it as well. Thank you very much, Lyndon. And Helen, I'm going to be heading back your way in just a second. So give me a few minutes and I'll be right back with you.
OK, Martin, see you in a minute. Now, Jackie McKinley's here. And Jackie, late last year, you had the amazing task of doing the micro-excavation of the Broomswell bucket. I mean, that must have been an absolute highlight of your career. What was it like?
Well, I do micro-excavation of vessels, you know, cremation urns on a fairly regular basis. But of course, the difference here is it's a metal object that you're taking things out of, and it's slightly different. Now, we'd had some fantastic sort of imagery done beforehand, CT scans and fancy busy stuff that had shown us an impression of what was going to be in there. But of course, that doesn't give you everything. You have to take the material out of there. So there were quite a few of us in York. We went up to York and in the conservation lab there. So there was a conservator, Sophie. Justin was there taking 3D images of everything at different stages.
Lovely.
And Naomi was also there in order to go through the material that we took out of the vessel and make sure there wasn't any organic material in it. So we're looking for things like pollen, stuff like that, because of course having the metal there...
It's so good for preservation, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. It will help potentially preserve organic materials that you wouldn't get, say, in a ceramic vessel in the same way.
And I remember that from Wynfarthing. Naomi got the most extraordinary results out of the contents of the bowl at Wynfarthing, which of course was in an inhumation, so it didn't contain any bones.
Well, of course, what tends to be, you've got payoff. If you get good organics, the chances are you are in an acidic burial environment, such as we have here, in which case the bone doesn't preserve very well. And vice versa, if you've got more alkaline burial environment, the bone preserves, but your organics don't. So there's always a payoff one way or the other.
So, but what was the bone like? That's the million-dollar question.
Well, surprisingly good.
Now, hello, everybody. Sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, you come at a good point, because I couldn't wait for Jackie to get to it herself. I've just said, what was the bone like?
Because this is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
How much was there, and how much could you identify?
Well, it's actually very intriguing from my point of view, because like I said, I do quite a lot of this sort of stuff, and I've done quite a lot of Anglo-Saxon burial remains. Now, we knew from the CT scan that roughly where things started, the depth of material we'd expect, and it was actually quite shallow. I would have expected perhaps a whole vessel full, but there was not a whole vessel full. It was only about 3 centimetres in depth That's not an awful lot of bone.
So do you mean that it started low down in the vessel? Because there's well, but actually, come to think of it, the strip that I've seen of the bucket is about 4 or 5 centimetres in depth. It's not huge.
No, it's not. And what happened in the first instance, I'd said, could they take away all the extraneous material? Mm. Because, of course, it had been disturbed. Mm. And a lot of the stuff in the very upper part was just fairly modern material that had got in there. Mm. And I'd asked them to stop at a certain point when I expected to find proper in situ remains. And one of the first things we found was the remains of a bone comb.
Now,
so this is a composite bone comb. So it's made up of several segments of bone comb and it's two-sided with a plate down the middle that holds it together. You know all about this sort of thing.
Yes, but the fact that you found it first, does that mean that it was on the top?
Yes.
It had been put in after the bones.
Exactly.
And was it wasn't burnt?
No, it was a grave good, not a pyre good. Now, I know we've discussed this before. But
sometimes, sometimes it doesn't matter when you're just saying what was put in with the burial. But at this point, it does matter.
It does matter. This was put on top of the bone. It was only added to the whole rite at the time of burial. It wasn't there at the time of cremation. The bone itself, what was interesting was we could see from the distribution of the bone, it hadn't just been put inside this vessel. It didn't spread all across the base of the vessel. It was set over slightly to one side. Now that to me says it was in a bag originally. It didn't just go straight into the vessel. It was in a bag. The bag was slightly displaced to one side. And as I said, it was actually quite a shallow depth. So once we'd got the remains very carefully, I left that to Sophie to lift the bone comb because the main bits of the comb weren't too bad. You know, the actual sort of bit, that the central bit that holds everything together, but the teeth were actually quite fragile.
I bet they were, yeah.
So I handed over to Sophie to let her lift those bits so that I could just say, not my fault, mate, you know. If it's gone wrong, not my problem.
It's always good to have loads of specialists around, isn't it?
So some amazing discoveries then already, but what work is still left to do?
Well, I have actually finished now doing my identification of the bone. A lot of it looked to me like animal bone. And in fact, the vast majority of it is animal bone. That's why I think there is something really interesting going on here, because these are a different type of deposit. It is so complex and there's a lot we do not yet understand, which is why I find what we're getting here really quite fascinating.
Fascinating, isn't it? Jackie, thank you so much. Thank you for all the work that you've done on the bucket, and I imagine you'll have your work cut out by whatever we find there. So
well, fingers crossed. Let's hope so. I've got to stop people talking about finding cremations, though.
Yes.
That will
we'll
never happen.
We'll start the campaign.
This is the Time Team podcast. Don't forget, you can fund us on Patreon, and it's the Patreon contributions that are paying for all of this.
It is, and I think we should go and have a little look at what's going on here on site so you can see where some of that Patreon money, thank you very much for it, is being spent. So let's have a little quick move around now from our position here by the dome, which is just behind us, and over to the trench, which is being worked on just over there. You can see the digger in action. We're going to go in through this gate here. After you, Helen.
Thank you.
Okay, in we go. And we've got Meg and Alex who are working down over there. Hi, Meg.
Hello.
And what they are doing is reopening part of the trench from last year, because not all of the features were excavated, and we're finishing off that bit in the context of a new trench. So how is it going, Meg and Alex?
It's going very, very well. Can you see this nice orangey areas?
You can have that.
Can you see these nice orangey areas that are coming up? That's our natural, so we found it.
Lovely.
And all we're doing is cleaning this back, cleaning the section back to the original section, and then we can start cleaning all the way back, finding those features that we haven't actually excavated yet.
So is this section nice and solid? Because it was damp last year, wasn't it?
Luckily, because it's been dry, it is very solid, and actually you just peel it back and it's this beautifully straight, perfect section still, which is really interesting, I think.
Yeah, it is. It does look really, really nice and neat. And I gather that we went straight down onto the old trench location, which just shows how brilliant the surveying was last year. So we're all in the right place, Martin. It's all going fine.
Good. Absolutely what I want to hear. Right, let's keep moving around the site. So we should get out of here. And I was just going to put... There's Martin Carver. Look, hello. Oh, pull it this way. There we are. Right, we're through. Hello, 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 Martin. Martin was on our previous podcast, by the way. You can go and listen to that right now, wherever you get your podcast. Come on, Helen, hurry up. I just want to very quickly take you across to this building here, just because it's worth knowing about. If you come to Sutton Hoo, this is a building worth seeing. It's a building you know very well, because what's it got in it?
It's got the exhibition. And what's it got underneath? It.
Oh, some more...
That's where this Anglo-Saxon cemetery was.
Yes.
That we are on the edge of now. So you can see through the window. That's one bit of the exhibition. Are we actually going to go in?
Well, we could.
We could do.
Have we got time?
Closes in 20 minutes.
Okay, well, we'll hurry up and we'll go in. What it's got...
Yes, now look at this. This is the outline of the ship, and on the other side you can see the other outline of the ship too. It was the first way of making sure that the visitor could see how big the ship was before we had any other way of demonstrating it to them before the reconstruction began.
It's so big they couldn't even fit it in the exhibition centre. So goodness knows what's going to happen to the ship restoration if they're never going to... They can't put it in here, can they? Hello.
I don't think we're allowed in until after hours.
Oh, it's closed. Right, it's closed. Well, that was very good. That worked well. So, if you want an idea of how big the ship really is, and you can't go in the exhibition centre, where can you go? You can have a look at the sort of skeleton of the ship, if you like, which is literally just in front of the exhibition centre and the cafe and all of that. This gives you a really good idea of just how massive the ship, which is in, well, under Mound 1 and Mound 2, how big it would have been.
Yes, well, the Mound 1 ship, we know exactly how long it was. I think, actually, these are a little bit too low. When you go to the reconstructed ship, it's a bit higher than this. The Mound 2 ship, of course, had been robbed several times and all of the ship rivets had been scattered. And the only way you can know what size it was is by adding up all the ship rivets that were ever found and thinking, what's the minimum size of ship that something with all those rivets could be? And it would have been so big that it wouldn't have fitted underneath the mound, because we know that the burial chamber was below because we could excavate that, and we think it would have stuck out either side of the mound like horns and cow pie. Weird, I know.
Very nice. Right, shall we get to some Patreon questions to end this episode of the Time Team podcast?
It's a good place to be doing it.
It's definitely a good place to be doing it. So let's just do that right now. Here comes the first question. Stephanie says, can't the ground be watered beforehand? This is an interesting point, isn't it? We just saw how sandy the ground is. Can't you just make it wet?
That is a good question, because of course we spent a lot of our time making it wet, yes. But actually, we can't really do it from the top, because it takes so much water and so much time. And everybody knows what it's like after, say, a month of it being dry and you have one rain shower and it just doesn't penetrate. And particularly through the turf, we'd have been having to spray it for a week. It really wouldn't make that much difference.
Okay, there you go, Stephanie. There's an answer. Great to hear you from... She's watching in Germany. Been a fan since 2005. Thank you. Lovely to have you on board. Final question then comes from Lorna, who says, has anyone tried to figure out how the ship was placed in the burial ground? Now, we were talking about this on our last podcast, about that nobody really knows how it was done. Did there used to be water surrounding it? Was it built on site? How many people would it have taken to move it to where it's found? There's so many questions here. Was it a burial vessel as it was being moved, as in, was the body and all the burial goods already in the boat as it was placed on the ground? So many questions, says Lorna. Yes, there are so many questions. Do we have some answers?
But they're all linked. Okay, so let me look back. Right, did there used to be water surrounding it? Well, no, that's the first thing. No, there wasn't water surrounding it, because we're 32 metres above sea level, so it's a long way from the river. And then, was it built on site? That's another no, because it had been damaged and it had been mended. So we know it was used before it was placed in the burial ground. How many people would it take to actually move it to where it was found? Now, I'm going to go back to Lorna's first question, which is, has anyone tried to figure out how the ship was placed in the burial ground? That is going to be the last experiment for the Sutton Hoo ship reconstruction project, because once it's been experimentally reconstructed and we've learnt everything we can from that, then we're going to launch it and we're going to take it out and do trials. We're going to start off with rowing. When we've finished our rowing trials, we're going to try sailing it. We're going to add a mast and a sail and all the rigging and so on, and then we're going to see how it sails and how it handles. And then the last thing we do, because we think it might break it, is we're going to try to drag it to do portage experiments. We do know that Viking ships are ported across peninsulas, and we're going to try to drag it and reconstruct the way in which it was brought up to the burial ground. There's one more. Was it a burial vessel as it was being moved? No, I don't think so, because it would have been so incredibly heavy. So they took out, if there was a mast, they took it out. They took out all the oars. We have no evidence of oars. They took off any steering gear. They seem to have removed everything, probably to make it lighter. Then they'd have built the burial chamber in it. But the thing that we don't know, and we're not going to be able to include in the experiment, is how was the trench in which it was placed shaped so perfectly that the ship hardly relaxed at all into it? There's been theories that it was dug a little larger and more sand was put in, but I've got to go back and check that. I'm fairly sure that it was dug incredibly carefully. That's not easy. It's not easy to dig a hole so that something as big as this fits into it absolutely perfectly with no room to sag.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. Brilliant questions. Yeah. Thank you very much for them. Keep them coming in on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial. You can join our little community there. We certainly love to hear from you. We will be back again next week from here at Sutton Hoo with another podcast. We're really looking forward to that. Thank you for listening and watching this one. Hope you made it to the end of it. It was slightly chaotic, I think. has to be said, but I think that's okay.
We live and learn.
We certainly do. And we will see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Time Team Podcast.